Okay, well, gentlemen, I have some exciting news. I finally found myself some office space. I've been looking for office space for probably a year. And all I needed, I was telling all the people that I talked to, I'm like, I don't need anything fancy. I don't need like these nice giant glass windows and stuff, like walls, the fishbowl office stuff. I just need a box, an enclosed box with an open floor space and some electrical outlets. And that, you wouldn't think that would be so hard to find. But I finally found a place and it has electrical outlets and it has an open floor plan. And I'm going to move out of my little 10 by 10 studio here that's in a converted bedroom that I've been working out of for, I don't know, 4 years now since we moved here. And it's going to be so nice. And I want you boys to praise me for how good of a job I did in finding this.
That's
so
nice. Please.
Congrats, man.
Wow, thank you.
No, don't congratulate him. Like the whole like spiel, the whole kind of essence of this fucking podcast is that it's extremely amateurish and all over the place. And now you're telling our viewership, listenership, whatever the fuck you want to call
Listen,
them.
I mean,
did you have an actual office space?
This is I had an office until very recently. I rented
Yeah,
office.
Noah, you had your own building.
I didn't have my own building. Don't. I'm not some fucking Rothschild.
That's how it starts. It starts with an office. Then you have a building. Then you need cleaners. And I need HR. I need a marketing department. And that's how we become one of them. Literally. Oh, sorry.
I don't think so. I don't know. I think it's more like I don't know. Like it's more Raymond Chandler. You know, more Lou Archer. It's you know.
Yeah.
There's a more. It's a kind of it's a measure of independence. I think. If anything,
I meant. I know you don't have a building. I just meant that you were working at an office that you were renting for yourself outside of your house, which I don't do, and I probably should. I like the idea of that, but you've been there. You just moved back to New York, so I guess that's over.
Yeah, that's over, because independence is overrated. I don't want to be a freeholder anymore. I want to be a bug man again.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, we have a 10-month-old baby, and she's wonderful and amazing, and I love her very much. But good God, I can't record anything in this house because she's always yelling or crying or, you know, screaming happily, but she's still screaming.
Stop. What's that American fucking term? Humble bragging and shit? Like, I just finally got this little room that I could turn into an office, thanks to our wonderful patrons, that I could get a fucking apartment or whatever the fuck. And now you're telling me that this is not good enough and you're moving
yes,
to an actual office. And you're humble bragging how you have a healthy, well-established family and you have a beautiful child. And oh my God, it's too loud.
Do you not have a baby?
Like, stop making me feel like shit. I am a baby.
you are the baby. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, I've liked working from home for a long time, and it's just gotten to the point where I'm trying to do too much with this little space. Like, I can do two setups in here, two different kind of things roughly, but I'm like, I'm trying to wedge a third set in here. I'm like, I can't do it. And if we're
That is dude speak. That is male speak for I don't want to like look at my wife and my kids for like 8 hours. That is literally
sad. Course. Everyone's going to think that, but it's just a coincidence. Mostly.
Of course,
mostly.
Of course.
So
the kid just got into the picture and he's,
I'm out of here.
Just now I need, yeah.
Goodbye, honey. I'll be back tonight. Yeah, no, that's a... Where do you guys record? Do you guys record in the same room for Blowback, or are you separate?
That's classified. We can't discuss the inner workings of the show.
We almost got him. Next time you got Nick.
Well, up until a point, they were obviously recording from, not in the same room, because one of them just said the other one moved to New York. So, but now if the other one is also
New York,
in
fact,
they might
be recording in the same place. We've always recorded in the same room, but he was in Jersey.
Mm.
So he would just... I mean, I'm speaking for you, Noah.
Yeah, no, and I was only in Jersey for the last year, so like, it's been, it's we've always recorded on location, so to speak, in Brooklyn.
Yeah, my bedroom.
That's
yes.
nice.
And it is my bedroom. On my desk, I've shelled out for good equipment.
Yeah,
which means that the actual environs don't have to be a studio that we pay for and. We can keep some costs down because everything sounds good. But we really shouldn't be giving up the ghost here, because one thing people always compliment us on is the show sounds pretty clean. And if they only knew on the hot days in August that Noah and I are bunched together in my rather cozy and small room, sharing the same microphone.
Oh, yeah.
With the AC turned off, because we can't have that bleeding into the sound, for hours at a time reading
all
off a
greasy,
script.
It is slipping and sliding. That's what I'm talking about, Failure.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know, that's it's nice to leave the room occasionally after you get that intimate, you know, with your co-host.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's a stark contrast to what we have here, because we have never seen each other in person.
That's how it should be.
Yeah, it's a fake internet job. Just keep it separate. Yeah. But yeah, we'd like to share one microphone. We'd like to get all cozy and sweaty together. We'll see if we can make that happen.
It's like drinking a milkshake out of the same milkshake with different straws with your friends.
And yeah, I am all cute. Backwash.
Oh God, Jesus Christ!
He's talking about it with the microphone, not even in the analogy. It's just coded.
Yeah, I'm speaking with this like halfway down my throat.
You're a Fremen.
That's how you get that resonance. Yeah.
You need a still suit in order to do the show, because all your moisture is.
No, I actually, the moisture has never been the thing for me. I think my favorite is the piano bench.
Yeah, that's the thing is I don't, what even is that? What I only have a nice office chair for me, and Noah always has to sit on this.
I want to be clear. You only have one chair.
Well, I used to have two. But you recall it's the other one swiveled around. It was rather unwieldy. So we just started using the piano bench that I use that I have for my piano.
That's cute.
And so I have lumbar support with my fancy office chair. And Noah is just hunched over this thing that is uncomfortable even for a piano.
Raw dog in a piano chair.
Yeah, exactly. But it's how we do it. And God damn it, it gets results.
Yeah.
You suffer for the craft. You can't argue with the final product.
We take away this setup, the whole thing goes to shit.
There's so much sexual tension between me, JT, and our third host.
Hakeem, I can hear
shout
it.
Out to him listening to this. No, trust me, in the first like 10 to 15 episodes, it was even more evident. But now, obviously, because of the distance, you know, it's starting to not fade away completely, but sure. It's a long distance relationship, obviously. And this guy now has a kid, so it's a bit more awkward.
Yeah, you need
to
start making peace with that.
I think we should, because I'm afraid that if we actually started recording in the same place, if God forbid, for example, we moved to Texas, which Jesus Christ, or JT, if you came to our normal countries, either in the Balkans or the Middle East, just the sexual tension will overtake actually recording the podcast. We would turn into what are those called? Like those weird shows where people are like whispering into microphones,
ASMR?
That fucking thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, just ASMR of, you know, click clocking and shit.
That sounds bad. Just keep it the way you're doing it.
We'll keep it long distance. Yeah, we'll keep it long distance for the safety of for ourselves, for our listeners, and for I think the world as a whole. Nobody needs to experience what that would be. But you know what? We have people writing fan fiction already, so maybe there is a market for it. We'll do a little bit of market research here.
The podcast to OnlyFans pipeline is very real, and we could exploit it, but let's try and ride this podcast thing.
Well, don't say ride if you want to avoid the overlap.
Shit.
Yeah. You already...
Yeah, I was playing into it before we start writing some other shit. But you know, it's the connection between here and Jersey.
Absolutely, haram.
Speaking of which, are you guys from Jersey? No, before we... Because I literally have, like, my girlfriend's cousins are literally landing right now, and they live in Jersey, and they're actually bringing me over. Like, I work on this very shitty, like, six-year-old laptop, and now I finally got a fucking Mac or whatever.
Nice.
Because JT convinced me to. And it's to everybody from outside of the U.S. who has a cousin in the U.S. listening to this, make them buy you shit when they come over, and if it's over $1,000, make them declare, you know, VAT tax or whatever, that it's for abroad. They give you a special document in almost all of the bigger stores. Then when they bring it over to you, take that document, and when you're passing, when you go to like whatever tax declaration thing you have in your hometown, it exists all over the European Union and outside of the European Union, go declare that you've been taxed for this and that you're going to go to the bank. They immediately give you the money before you actually go to the bank. Then don't go to the bank, and you get 15% to 20% back off the actual item that you ordered.
Just yeah, it's a real simple trick. It's one simple trick.
Yeah, that's like the beginning
actually
of
recording this from his jail.
That's
cell.
Like what's his face in Hard Eight teaching the main guy
Philip Baker Hall, John C.
Yes,
Reilly.
Thank
yeah.
you. Yes, how to like make money at the casino.
Yeah.
No, it works. I've done it with like 100 things, but it's much easier when you physically pass the border, because when you're physically passing a border, you declare it at the first border. So you're like, oh, look, I bought TV, and they tell you how much TV, and you say, oh, $1,000, and then they give you 15% of the $1,000. So they give you $150 back, but they give you $150 back because they want to do what? They want to inspire you to keep buying from that particular country, because, hey, we're giving you tax back. Whenever you enter your country, they're going to ask for those $150. So you give them back, right, to the country that you're importing to. The only thing you should do is when you're moving into the next country, you just don't declare it. They're like, what's that TV in your back? And you're like, I just like to drive around with my TV. Like, they cannot prove that, you know, you bought the particular item. And that's how you get it. But via plane, it's a bit more complicated, especially but then when it comes from the States, nobody asks for anything because the documents are too complicated, et cetera. So they just give you the money, and it's a win-win. And when you buy something, for example, for $5,000, that's $1,000 for you to drink or snort or eat or whatever you're into. It's a win-win. Sorry.
Well, that's there it. You go. There's Ugopnik's unethical life pro tip.
Why
for the
unethical?
Day.
Why? Fucking not, Apple just, is fucking
all I'm
up
saying,
the ass
all
with
I'm
a $5,000 laptop. Like, I get
all
to take
I'm
some
Jesus Christ. Okay, all I'm saying is, dear listeners, here at the D Program, we do not encourage or condone criminal activity of any sort. please do not cite the D Program in any of your criminal escapades. Thank you for listening.
All of this was for entertainment purposes only.
Parody. Howdy, y'all. Today we have with us for the first time both halves of the Blowback podcast, Noah Colwin and Brendan James. You might remember Brendan from our episode on the last season of Blowback about the Korean War, so he's back to collect his second appearance challenge coin. Does that make him second only to Alan McLeod in terms of appearances?
I mean, he's sharing the spot with a few other people, so if he comes back one more time in the next season of Blowback...
Next season, he'll be...
Now I have to.
Now you gotta. All right.
There wasn't even
Noah,
gonna be another
hand,
season.
There better be another season.
No,
please.
Of course there will be.
Please. Okay. Noah, on the other hand, is a coward and a rascal, and this is his first appearance. Anyway, the Blowboys, as they've asked to be called, are the brains behind the wildly popular Blowback series, which is about to drop its fourth season, this time on the war in Afghanistan. Their past three seasons have been about the Iraq War, the Cuban Revolution, and the Korean War. And we highly recommend you guys check those out. So, Brendan, Noah, thank you guys for coming on. And please tell the audience just a little bit about who you are and why you started this project.
Well, your audience knows me so well already. I'll let Noah go first.
Sure. I'm Noah. I do. I help write Blowback, and I'm one of the co-hosts. But Brendan is the production and editing genius. And I'm also a journalist. I got my start as a reporter working for the website Recode, which no longer exists. And then I worked for Vice News, which will probably soon no longer exist. and then I've worked as a freelancer and in different staff jobs at places like Jewish Currents. The Outline also doesn't exist. And it's kind of nuts. I haven't ever really considered
that. So it sounds like you're the kiss of death.
I know. That's what I'm putting together right now as I'm talking. Holy cow.
Boot him from the call. The Deep Program is going to stop existing like a week after this.
Yeah, I'm thinking all of a sudden, do one of you guys want to take his spot? Because I'm getting bad juju.
And then, like Lazarus, I started working on Blowback. But no, I also write articles for all sorts of other outlets, and you can find my bylines and whatnot at noahcolwin.com.
I didn't know that he was on noahcolwin.com. but I'm Brendan. I am the other half of Blowback. I co-host the show, write the show, and I do the production and the music, which I will undoubtedly have to plug later on. Yes. And, you know, I have a background in journalism, not totally dissimilar to Noah, but, you know, these days, especially right now, we're recording this while I'm still finishing season four, and it is a labor of love, but we're right down to the wire. And I'm a hermit-like in my room working on it.
Yeah, dear listeners, we are recording this on the 17th of August, so we've got like a week to go before season four drops. These boys are they're feeling the heat, it sounds like. But let's go ahead. I think this is going to be a longer episode. We've got a actually a bunch of questions here. And Yugopnik is going to take the kind of the first part of the history of the Afghanistan stuff, and then I'm going to jump in a little bit later with the more recent stuff. So Yugopnik, take it away.
Just like, hi guys, again, thank you very much for coming. Just recapping like the short Afghani history before the topics that you guys covered was kind of a nightmare when it comes to me thinking, oh my God, I will actually have to like say these names and read this stuff out loud. I can't imagine what it was like for you guys to record, obviously, all of these names, which are, I guess, culturally very far away and very difficult to say the least pronounce. Even
we don't always nail the pronunciations. We're getting better every season, but inevitably, you know, we don't speak.
There's only so
the
much
language.
You can do.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that the effort is what counts, yeah. And we don't always nail it, but we try. Damn it!
So before we start, is it Afghanistan, as we call it? Like what in your perspective should we be calling this country throughout?
Americans typically put the emphasis on the second syllable, Afghanistan. Yeah. I wouldn't want to necessarily lecture on what the most correct and native pronunciation would be. It's funny, though, actually bringing this up, because sometimes people, to be oh so clever, they will tell you if you say Pakistan, for example.
Oh, yeah.
They'll say, you mean Pakistan?
And Barcelona. Barcelona, yes.
And someone asked me that recently. And of course, like I said, you know, I'm always willing to make as much effort as anyone asks me, but I have several friends from Pakistan, and when I say Pakistan, they don't bat an eye, they don't care. And in fact, they brought up to me, you know, it's really more, if there's anything you want to hem more toward, it is the emphasis on the syllables rather than the necessary like accent. And so recently someone was like, oh, you mean Pakistan? And I was like, well, how do you say Afghanistan? Do you say Afghanistan? And they were like, well, no. And I was like, well, then shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it applies to one word and not another. You kind of just got to roll with whatever communicates your points best. And that's what we've tried to do. But with names, you know, you strive for the most fidelity.
Every language has a particular accent when, saying words that are not from that particular language, and that's absolutely fine. Anybody nitpicking shit like that should be saying shit like, oh, I heard a really good joke from this guy from Deutschland, like every time they record, like they're referring to something which
from Paris.
Yeah. Barcelona no is my absolute that. Fucking favorite. Yeah. But okay.
Well, Hakeem isn't here, so this is a safe space.
Like, it is. This fucking guy was here right now.
I can hear him in my ear right now. He's like, Astaghfirullah, it's Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, yeah, absolutely.
Afghanistan, I can't do it. There are just some sounds that are very difficult for English speakers. But yes, let's continue.
Absolutely, most, but I still love you guys.
Thank you.
So I guess, what, like JT, 55, 60% of our listenership is American, so I guess I'll call it Afghanistan. So let me start with my first small quasi-intro and then moving into the first question. The history of Afghanistan is marked by a succession of empires and kingdoms, each leaving their mark on the region. Ancient civilizations such as the Greco-Bactrians, Indo-Scythians, Kushans, and others rose to power in Afghanistan. The land saw the prominence of Indo-Iranian languages due to the influence of ancient Iranian peoples. Over time, Afghanistan was integrated into various vast empires, including the Achaemenid, Macedonian, and Maurya empires. The region's cities like Bagdad, Kabul, Herat, and others served as important centers of these empires. The ancient history of the land where Afghanistan sits today dates back to the prehistoric era, with archaeological evidence suggesting human habitation over 50,000 fucking years ago.
Wow.
The Indus Valley civilization extended into parts of Afghanistan, connecting it with trade and culture. Through various stages, Afghanistan saw the rise of different empires, including the Kushans, who were patrons of Buddhism, the Sassanids, Indo-Sassanids, and the Turk Shahis. The arrivals of the Mongols, led by Genghis Khan, and the subsequent rise of the Timurid Empire brought further changes to the region. This leads us to Babur, who captured Kabul and established the Mughal Empire in India, ending Afghanistan's medieval and ancient histories, and opening us up to Blowback's Afghani history, a story of the evolution of imperial conquest, batshit idiotic state decision-making, and, most importantly, a story about one of the toughest motherfuckers in the world, the modern Afghanis, who have very much earned themselves their country's title, a grave of empires. So please start us out where your show begins. What's the first invasion you covered?
Well, that was a very, very well condensed history. We do something much like that in the first or the second episode, I suppose. And we try to run through a lot of that background ourselves. As you mentioned, you know, technically the first invasion we mention is a string of ancient ones that you've already gone through. But getting into the modern history, we start with the British, of course. I'll say before we even get there, the quote you mentioned, the kind of turn of phrase, graveyard of empires, which is, I think, one of the more popular conceptions among regular people about Afghanistan. We've all sort of heard that phrase, or at least anyone who's, you know, been exposed to commentary on Afghanistan has heard that. It sounds like one of those phrases that comes from maybe the British Empire earlier that kind of can be transposed onto today in a historically ironic way, but it was actually coined as recently as 2001. Hmm. And it was coined by a CIA station chief back during the 1980s, or rather one who was the CIA station chief in the 1980s, a guy named Milt Bearden. And he comes up in the show. He's a character in our show. Very interesting guy. Apart from his work for the CIA, he then kind of, as some of them do, left the agency, or in some capacity left the agency, and was a little bit more publicly cranky about American foreign policy and the dirty work that he did for all those years. And he's the one who coined that term. But, you know, he knew of what he spoke. So, we start with the British and go through the first three Afghan Anglo wars, which were kind of a 19th century. And then at the last one took place in the 20th century, the sort of table setting for what would happen in the rest of our story.
So there were three. Let's start with the first one. Why did the Brits go into Afghanistan? And I know this is like asking why the Brits went into anything. It's kind of like a no-brainer question. Because
water,
you know,
water is wet.
Water is wet, exactly. But still.
Look, they had museums. They needed to put stuff in the museum, right?
Yeah, we just opened the new Cecil Rhodes wing, and we got to fucking fill it up.
Oh, Jesus.
We can run through the three, I think, in one go here, because they're very much connected, as you might imagine, in terms of what the British goals were long term. The first Anglo-Afghan War was seen in the middle of the 19th century, was seen basically as a way to shore up British India. And that's something we try to get across in our first episode for the rest of the season, even though we go way beyond the British, is that in this incredibly important prehistory to our show, the British conquest and the Western meddling in Afghanistan was chiefly to expand or secure or, in their minds, defend the territory of British India. Because, of course, Afghanistan at that time was right next door. Pakistan did not exist yet. And indeed, the existence of Pakistan on what was formerly British India is going to be a big reason why conflicts persist. So the First Anglo-Afghan War was really, as the British imagined it, a way to shore up that Indian breadbasket against an insatiable Russian empire that they thought was moving day by day to disrupt and dismantle their Asian conquests. And in fact, going in, they doctored evidence to make it seem like Russia was about to take over the whole region. And it was a secret war that was basically kept secret from Parliament itself. And once it became known that the British were fighting in Afghanistan, they offered a rather Iraq war style set of false smoking guns and dossiers and things like this. And then the second war happened not too long after the British at that point had been routed. I think they lost about 20,000 soldiers in the first war, which back then was a lot, you know, pre-World War One. That's a shitload of troops to lose. And they learned by then that it's very hard, as you made reference to, Yagopnik, it was very hard to control Afghan territory, as many a Khan had learned before that. And in the second war, they essentially played it a little smarter and just installed more pliant leaders, or attempted to, and then got out of there. And it went better for the British this time. And part of the reason it went better, it was because as hard as it is for an empire to come in and win a war in Afghanistan, there is also a very longstanding set of disputes within Afghanistan among different parts of the country, or what we think of as the modern lines of the country, etc. And there was more sort of disunity the second time around for the Afghans. And then finally, the third one takes place in the top of the 20th century, because a very progressive king, King Amanullah, who would initiate a lot of reforms that we think of as things that, quote unquote, Afghanistan needed. He initiated loads of reforms against the landowning class, a big promoter of the rights of women, etc. And part of that fucked with the British agenda there. And he also made problems for the British on the Durand Line, which was the line between British India, the border between British India and Afghanistan. And so that was the third pretty brief war that took a long time to get a treaty out of. And at that point, Amanullah was so fed up with the British that he was the first leader, and Afghanistan was the first government to make nice with the Soviet Union, which was soon to be, you know, sharing a border with them. And that's a kind of speed run of those first three wars.
I'm going to ask, like, an obviously Eurocentric, and I would borderly argue a tiny bit racist question.
Oh, thank God.
Let's do a bit of racism. But it's a question in most people's minds, let's be fucking honest here, who, you know, don't know a lot about Afghanistan in general. You have, on this one side, like, the empire where the sun never sets, and then you have, you know, again, the Eurocentric, semi-racist view of Afghanistan, which is a bunch of rocks, right?
Right.
And these guys managed to, like, wipe the floor with them in three consecutive wars. And then afterwards, as we're going to talk throughout the episode, many different states and empires and so on and so on. Why? How? What the fuck?
I would emphasize a couple things. The first of which is that, like, the British committed vast atrocities. And when you consider, if you think of, like, the scope of war to sort of include that amount of bloodshed, to me, it's sort of like that's what the Afghans were fighting against. So part of it is the like just the fierceness of people who are, like, you know, fighting against their countrymen being slaughtered. And then the other thing I would sort of note is that, you know, because this area is you know, so, like, relatively underdeveloped, and it's also, you know, managed, you know, vast swaths of territory are, you know, politically managed by forms that have, you know, not evolved all that much in, you know, hundreds of years, you know, key ties of kinship across hundreds of miles. This is not an area that, like, a you know, maintaining a counterinsurgency, like, what happens when you put a garrison of troops in like the one village for a surrounding area? It becomes a target. You know, these were principles, by the way, that, you know, sort of became, you know, they may seem obvious to us now, but America had to learn them, you know, quite viscerally in Vietnam, most of all. So this was, you know, for what it's worth, like, a somewhat novel experience, sure, but it was because of, you know, stuff that, like, you know, just the classic, you know, mistake of an empire seeing a piece of territory, seeing its strategic value as protecting its, you know, protecting Iran and protecting India from the Soviet Union and, you know, perhaps one day China, you know, if that, you know, et cetera. I mean, it, you know, and just underestimating the ease with which they're going to be able to, you know, suppress the population and install a loyal, stable political regime.
And all these things are linked, of course, but besides the organization of society, whether it's the, you could say, underdeveloped or whatever, I don't know if there's a politically correct alternative to describing this stuff, but the fact was that the Afghans were very interested in modernization. We just mentioned King Amanullah, who was driven into exile partially by religious revolts that were backed by the British. Mm-hmm. And after he left, I believe he was gone by 1927. After he left, all of the reforms he was working on, things that the Westerners now say they love, like women's rights and modern industry, they were reversed with the approval of the British. And so the political and social organizations aside, obviously the geography matters a lot too. You had, you know, these kind of classic British armies wading into what was essentially guerrilla warfare in the 19th century and onward. You know, that's existed in many different places for all time. But the terrain, the mountainous terrain, I mean, even not to jump around too much here, but the Americans compared to the Iraq war, Afghanistan was in some places even harder to control 100 years after the British were there, because Iraq, it's got a lot of metropolitan areas. It's got a lot of, you know, the Ba'ath Party developed quite a bit of modernity and modern life sort of existed in Iraq in a way that wasn't true for large swaths of Afghanistan. And the terrain and sort of effects of the terrain, and then, of course, the colonial ambitions of the surrounding states meant that it was a really hard place to be able to set down a garrison and not get your shit kicked out of you. And then when you would pacify an area, you'd leave. And then everyone would just pour right back in. You'd have to take it again. It was much more of a kind of give and take sort of seesaw. Not so much in the World War I sense, but in that more modern, I think Americans think of, the guerrilla wars of Vietnam. Totally different type of territory than Vietnam, but a similar principle.
And there's, I would also, there are two other things that sort of come to mind that are important here. The first of which is that, like, a lot of what people conceive of as, like, the Afghan state or Afghan governance and, like, Afghan civil society is, you know, and this is not, like, This is not like a 100%, this does not apply 100%, but like it is dominated predominantly in Kabul. It's in the capital. And much of the, when there are wars and there is like, you know, substantial conflict in the country, and, you know, it's really only until the 1990s that Kabul begins to actually see like sustained destructive conflict. So there is also like a kind of, you know, if like a sort of more classic perspective of like, yeah, there's like this one gigantic urban core and then just like vast stretches of like unincorporated, uncharted territory, socially uncharted. I mean, not literally uncharted. And then the other thing here is that Afghanistan's eastern border, as like Pakistan and like partition takes place later in the century, you know, what was previously a kind of a dynamic that was present in Riel, which was the fact that, like, you know, that people could just move into Paktia and into these provinces toward the east, into these regions and into Pakistan itself, or what, you know, what is today Pakistan. And so there was also, like, you know, it's not like, like what today may be conceived of as you know, stable Pakistan territory was also like an outlet for a lot of these fighters and a lot of these warriors. There were you know, the lack of like borders and state authority in that way has also always made it a lot easier. So when we say that like people can move around and like, you know, escape, like that's part of what we're describing, is just the ability for, in the absence of, again, like, you know, the same kind of system of borders and structure and enforceable borders that you've got elsewhere on the planet, like, yeah, it's a lot fucking harder to keep track of, say, like, you know, thousands of motivated guerrilla fighters, whether they're fighting for Islam or for their country.
Great answers. And that makes absolute sense. And I remember first few times that I was reading about Afghanistan, and not even reading, like watching documentaries of how these particular, you know, it's a modern term, but we can absolutely apply it to them, how these guerrillas from also very often different tribes that did not communicate amongst each other, but knew what a particular mutual enemy is when it comes to whatever army at that point was trying to invade that particular territory, how they would combat them in manners and ways which the enemy absolutely never could either anticipate time-wise, strategy-wise, or just the repetitiveness of, you know, you being able to move in, take a few out, then move back, move out, then move back in a few nights later, and so on and so on, without really wasting any resources. I'm talking from the perspective of the attackers, because you're literally in your own land, you've been living there for like 34 years, and the other guys have to have, you know, fucking equipment and food and water travel thousands of miles miles in order for them to arrive to your spot so that you can eventually maybe fire back. And when you're firing back, you're confused if you're firing at a bush or a guy who knows like every inch of that particular territory that you're trying to take over, so on and so on and so on. Okay, so we covered now what the Brits did in their three fucking wars. Jesus Christ. What happened between that period, if you could please tell us, and the Soviet war? I know it's a quite a vast amount.
A lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. So I apologize in advance. But I guess we can touch, I don't know, around First World War, Second World War, and then the different important kings and leaders and so on that you would mention.
Yeah. To kind of float above a lot of the nitty gritty stuff, which we go into in the show, episode
which
two
you can
is
find down in the link. Yeah, absolutely.
Which you can find down in the link in the description. It was a real challenging episode to edit because of exactly, you know, how much goes on in this period. So if I had to sum it up, I would say that as we just discussed, partially out of the British wars alienating the reformer king Amanullah from any sort of friendly relations with the British, who at that point were still the top dogs in the West as a, you know, the point man of capital in the world and all that. The Soviet Union and Afghanistan were fast friends from the beginning. And that meant that while the Afghans did value their independence, World War One, Afghanistan was not in any kind of direct line of ideological allegiance with anybody. What's interesting is that in World War One, the Germans had a plan. Aping the British, they had a plan to begin and in fact administer and jumpstart a Islamic revolt in Afghanistan and elsewhere to largely hit the British where it hurt in India. Again, a strategy that will of course be taken up in the Cold War by the Americans. Then you get into the World War II period. The Afghans were not unfriendly to the Germans, actually, and they got a lot of military equipment for the Germans. But by the time, the war was over, they were largely, you know, preserved as a monarchy in the same way they had been before. And there was a young king named Zahir Shah, who will be a kind of a figurehead for the rest of his life, whether he's in power or not. And then we get into the Cold War, and that's really the meat of our show. And the Soviets and the Afghans cooperated on a lot of stuff. It was a constitutional monarchy, essentially. And the Americans, some I'm sure within the government, wished we were doing more to quote unquote win Afghanistan, win Central Asia. But the Soviets were just giving them more, particularly in the form of military support and advisors. You know, they wanted their own army because in 1947, we get the partition of India and the creation of Pakistan. And Afghanistan was the only country not to recognize Pakistan because there was this pre-existing dispute. And forever after a dispute over this border that the British drew between Afghanistan and British India, which Pakistan sort of supplanted. And so the Soviets and the Afghans were kind of one team, and the Americans became friendly with the Pakistanis, who they viewed as kind of British trained, you know, well-spoken collaborators that they could work with. And they were not
one of
totally
the good
wrong,
ones,
so,
quote unquote, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's never just black and white, but really, we spoke to Ahmed Rashid, a great journalist, about this stuff, and he spelled it out essentially in that way, that the Soviets paired with the Afghans and the Americans paired with the Pakistanis, with kind of British mediation, because of course the British were retreating at that point. And where the British retreated, the Americans went in, and that meant as well that they were looking to make nice with the future generations of Afghanistan, even if they weren't winning at that moment. So there are a lot of Afghanistan elites who go to America to study and get degrees and bring their stuff back home and maybe bring some connections with American agents home. And that is where we will not spoil it here, but there are some rather unlikely candidates for that type of stuff that end up right in the middle of the Afghan communist revolution that took place in 1978, which the Soviets, by all evidence, did not plan and did not really know what to do with once it happened.
Yeah, I mean, so it's, you know, there are a couple details worth pulling out. Like, for example, the American ambassador to Afghanistan is killed in a very bizarre incident, like a kidnapping by a supposedly left-wing, I believe, was it left-wing terrorists, Brennan?
Supposedly, I've seen a lot of stuff on this. Some accounts say it was a Maoist group. Some accounts say it was a splinter group from the
right.
from the, you know, the whatever Orthodox Marxists. I do, some say it was maybe secretly a religious group. It's a little foggy.
We call all those freedom fighters in this show, by the way. So religious yeah. groups, Maoists, Marxists. I'm not fucking around. No, please go on.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a weird, tense kind of situation, and the party itself, and its, you know, its attempt at a program, like I know
the
that
Afghan
there's a,
Communist Party. You mean.
Yeah, yes, the Afghan Communist Party. You know, they attempted to do a lot very quickly without really the political base to kind of support the broad social revolution that they wanted to pursue. You know, and they were always sort of being, you know, with the Soviet Union at their back saying, you know, like chill out, do less, please. and ultimately, you know, there is this, you know, incident where the Afghan prime minister, after a confrontation with the president, he's killed and replaced, and there and the and then from that point forward, once then there is now this supposed pretext for ramped up American support for the Mujahideen in place. You then see the beginning, sort of, you know, it's a steady escalation.
But we should be clear, actually, that the just to not to preclude what you're about to say, that the support for religious extremists within Afghanistan yes. began not only before the Soviet invasion, which is actually admitted to by everyone from Robert Gates to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the CIA, future CIA director in the case of Gates, and the national security advisor who really was the key architect of Operation Cyclone, Zbigniew Brzezinski. I think it would be fair to call him a Russophobe who was very much looking to kind of tap into the great game style politics of the British era against Russia or the Soviet Union, that it was before 1978 when the coup or revolution took place, whatever your politics call that thing. And it was really, we tend to find in the show, in the early 70s, because there was a different coup that was a kind of a done by a secular liberal, basically. And his name was Mohammed Daoud. And he, I could sum up his politics and his plan of navigating the Cold War with a great quote he gave reporters, which was, "I want to light my American cigarette with a Russian match or a Russian lighter." And he was pretty good at doing that for a while, although it was always more favored toward the Soviets. I think the Western press called him the Red Prince. But he was killed by the communists because at that point he himself had started to lose legitimacy. And that gave the communists an opening. But we were fooling around with guys who would end up in the Mujahideen years later in the early 70s, guys like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is still around today as a power broker in Afghanistan and one of the original acid in the faces of women type guys. Ahmed Shah Massoud, who was has a much more sanitized reputation in the West, but people we speak to called just as much a criminal as Hekmatyar. These guys we were already kind of getting in touch with through Pakistan.
But the first time the Yanks are getting in touch with the Mujahideen is after...
Early 70s.
So after the, what was it, People's Democratic Afghanistan Party.
Before.
The Communists.
Well before.
Or even
well
before the Communists. Well before.
Before
okay,
the Communists.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 73 was the prime minister taking over and just yeah. getting rid of the monarchy. And then 78... was the communist revolution. And so it was before 78. And it wasn't as organized. It wasn't as structured. It certainly wasn't as well funded. That began to happen under Zbigniew Brzezinski. But the idea that we started pursuing an allegiance with reactionary religious fundamentalists in Afghanistan to undermine a modern government, be it communist or progressive, that was before the Marxist coup or revolution, and certainly before the Soviet invasion.
Which is super interesting because during the Cold War, that was always used as like internal PR, at least for like people with PhDs who ask that sort of question on why are we working with these absolute fucking psychos talking about the Mujahideen? Oh, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We're fighting the horrors of communism and so on. And then everybody's like, okay. But when you introduce this to the conversation, the fact that, you know, the Yanks were working with the Mujahideen much earlier on, even that extremely flimsy, although obviously ideologically backwards argument also falls through.
It's like Guatemala, right? No, it's like he wasn't a communist in Guatemala. Our Benz.
No, you know? But he was. I mean, it's, you know, makes enough noise. And also, I think, you know, there's a you know, what I would say is the other there are still a couple other big kind of explanatory factors that are going on, that are in the world at that moment. The first of which is, you know, 1979 was earth shattering, and like Afghanistan
great
took
song.
On, in 1979, I mean, you have Iran goes from being America's number one military client in Asia to being its number one military rival in Asia, or like, you know, opponent in
boogeyman
Asia. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. What real threat it posed, obviously, you know, probably not much.
Turban man, yeah, classic. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and then, so there's that. And then simultaneously, you know, the Americans are, you know, as part of the strategy to figure out how are we going to counter that, they start to, and they had already basically, the CIA had built the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence agencies, the GND and the ISI respectively, they built them from the ground up. And they're in a position to kind of help, you know, manifest this gigantic arms and, you know, police state influx, you know, I mean, such that like Pakistani and South Asian, you know, military officers are exported to Gulf states to this day. That like is, you know, that's part of what's built at this time. So there is also like, you know, when people are thinking like, gee, why is there, you know, where was all this, you know, war in Afghanistan? It's like, well, in part because like we started sending arms and guns to not just Afghanistan, but literally everybody immediately in the neighborhood, you know, everybody in the neighborhood all of a sudden, you know, got, you know, they either got
the wackiest groups. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a literal club.
yes.
It was called the Safari Club by its
You're
members.
You're fucking me.
Now, I'm not kidding, and we talk about this in the show, and we won't go on too much about it here, but there was an association, and this is from the mouth of one of the Saudi heads of intelligence who later gave an interview at Georgetown. So he freely admits this because it was so long ago, they start to get, you know, they get a little cocky and they start going, oh, actually, yeah, that's all true. It was called the Safari Club colloquially. It had other names. It was an association between the intelligence agencies of the United States, Pakistan, the ISI, the Saudi intelligence, which George H.W. Bush in the 70s brought the CIA much closer in contact with, and Egypt, Israel, there's even, you know, it's even reported that Saddam Hussein was kind of in on this. And it was essentially, one pair of authors calls it the international equivalent. Oh, by the way, the Chinese communists as well were kind of in the loop here, because they had made peace with America at that point. And the Soviet Union at that point was a bigger enemy to China, practically speaking, as far as they were concerned, I guess, than the great Satan was. So the Chinese communists are going to play actually a huge role in arming the Mujahideen. And we try to talk about that in the show when we can. But the Safari Club was an anti-communist association that this pair of writers that are very good call kind of the international version of Nixon's plumbers unit. And they got to, and the Shah of Iran, as Noah just said. So the Shah, Saudi Arabia, the United States, Pakistan, they were all beginning to use banks like BCCI, I'm sure you guys have talked about before, these channels of dirty money to off the books and offshore from the United States, organize an anti-communist policy in Asia. And that one of the places that was really happening was Afghanistan itself, both before and after the communist revolution. So that means that by that point, you know, you're it's not too crazy to talk about it as a conspiracy, you know, an organized plan to make this happen. And so when we get to your next question, sorry, folks at home, I'm pulling the curtain back. We were sent the questions as to why the Soviets did this. I think that needs to be kept in mind, this association of intelligence networks.
But when it comes to what the Soviets were planning on doing on the ground in the case of a magical potential victory, was it ever like internally discussed? Do we have access to information on what at least the Soviet leadership was thinking? Mm-hmm. Like, what was the actual plan for Afghanistan in case they would have won? Like Poland 2.0, which basically is the Polish, like themselves very often say, we were just sitting around waiting for these guys to leave, or was there something else involved? Because we obviously know that the Communist Party that took over, you know, relatively good intentions in the beginning, and afterwards everything went, like, respectfully to an extent to shit. We even also have one episode on that particular era itself. So what were the Soviets really expecting? Sorry for the long-winded question.
I think it's, you know, like there wasn't a strategic, this was not a war that they pursued with enthusiasm, and they didn't have like this long-term strategic vision for, you know, what the war booty or, you know, what the advantages of victory were. They went in to stabilize a friendly regime, and they viewed that regime as being a critical geopolitical ally for a number of reasons, you know, whether it's oil pipeline, you know, routes, whether it's the fact that if it's, you know, occupied by a government that can, you know, start sending raiders into the Soviet Union. The Afghan war in the 1980s, a lot of American officials are just very obsessed with killing, you know, like, to be glib about it, like, you know, taking Russian scalps, so to speak. Like they wanted,
and to be literal about it.
They wanted to, you know, they wanted to, that access. So in the case of the Soviet Union, not incorrectly, you know, when Yuri Andropov and Brezhnev and the rest of the is it still the Presidium at that point?
But it was the Politburo.
The Politburo. They're, you know, when they're confronted with this, it's, you know, very few of them are happy to go into this. And in fact, many people in the military are like, this is no. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
They voted like five times over the course of the year preceding the war not to agree to the Afghans' request for troops. And by the sixth time, things had degenerated so much inside of Afghanistan due to both the rising tide of the Mujahideen, which was at that point going like gangbusters thanks to the support of the West, the Safari Club, and the rather bloodthirsty policy of Hafizullah Amin, who we talk about in the show as a very fascinating character. Some believe was at that point, and in fact, there is evidence at that point that he was turning toward the Americans. And so the Soviets said, look, we're either going to get a bunch of religious fanatics right over our border, because that at that point, you know, the Central Asian states were part of the Soviet Union. It was their border with Afghanistan. We're either going to get that, or we're going to get this psycho hardline communist who we don't even like. He was not their favorite at all, because I'm sure if you guys talked about the PDPA, the Afghanistan Communist Party, you would have mentioned that it was not, I mean, you could call it well-intentioned. I don't know. I leave the judgments up to others.
Maybe the first year, yeah.
It was a party at war with itself.
Yeah.
There were two factions. There was the hardliner faction, or the Khalki faction, which was largely Pashtun, ethnically Pashtun. And there was the Parcham faction, which was more gradualist and pro-Soviet. And the Soviets really didn't love having this messy revolution on their border at all, but they did favor the Parcham guys. And so Hafizullah Amin, who was a kind of Saddam Hussein figure in some ways, he was number two for a long time, and then eventually he performs a kind of coup within the coup and becomes number one. He starts chopping heads off left, right, and center. And that means that when the Soviets went in, they were in some sense doing regime change because they were removing him, but they were also trying to keep the government secular and stable and all this other stuff. And at the end, Amin seemed to be more than flirting with both Americans and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the religious fanatics in order to maybe shed his skin as a Marxist and become more of a kind of opportunistic ideological vacuum and just stay in power with whoever he could. And so the Soviet reasoning, very reluctant, and in fact, they rejected the Afghans over and over again, in the year previous, they finally said, it'll probably be a mess, but this might be worse if we let this happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why they went in. And they were supposed to, their plan was to be there for 6 months to a year, and they wanted to get out.
That's exactly why I was kind of like not baiting the answer, but it's very important to note exactly what you just very eloquently put that the situation, because usually how it's pitched is the best of friends of Soviets ruling in Afghanistan, and they're like they love each other, and then the beautiful masses of Afghanistan rise up because they do not want this bloodthirsty communist thing, and then evil Soviets roll in to protect their evil communism thing. That is how it's pitched in like 90% of school curriculums,
sure,
while it's 10 times more complicated as you put forward. That doesn't
It was a huge mess, and one that they you know, we grapple a little bit in the show with this like Russia's Vietnam narrative, because it was that was a line that was easy to push to the Western press, and the U.S. very government strange agencies loved that narrative, because it, for a lot of reasons you can imagine, it both made us lose track of the actual Vietnam War that had only ended a couple years earlier, which was still had ramifications, and made it seem as though we could play the anti-imperialists against the imperialist Russians doing Vietnam. But the circumstances are very different as to why the Soviets went in. Now, if you're an Afghan dodging helicopter gunfire in 1985, or a CIA-trained Islamic soldier, you're trying to bob and weave between these things, you don't necessarily care what the Soviet motivation was. Mm-hmm. But what it does illuminate is how statecraft was going on either side, what could have been avoided, what was, as Zbigniew Brzezinski, though he denies it, called the Afghan trap, which was that the U.S. policy was to draw them into a Vietnam-style quagmire, and it succeeded. And we have some interesting interviews that go into the what some one historian has called, oh, that's just a big myth. There was no trap. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite credible to piece together the story with the trap being the only real explanation.
An extremely controversial question. Do we see a repeat, maybe, of this sort of bait thing with, 2014 and now 2021
Ukraine
bait and switch thing, or is it a very different situation? Obviously,
I'm flapping my gums, but I was just reading about this, and I think that there is something comparable. Mm-hmm. I think there's something comparable going on. I wouldn't want to say it's the exact same thing. But, I mean, we know that the American government supported the Independence Square protests. We know that they were eventually hijacked by extremists and that the democratically elected government fell and that provocations continued after that. It didn't end there. And that we dangled NATO membership over and over again with no real intention of following through with it. Mm-hmm. And had, I don't think it's unfair to say, encircled. Yeah. A sort of declining Russia with more paranoid and xenophobic tendencies than it had ever had before, with a bunch of NATO states, and seemed to be really interested to see how far we could push them to finally, go hog wild. I think there's definitely a conversation to be had there. Yeah.
If for example, there is destiny and there's like some bearded guy in the sky, like, quote unquote, writing history, at this point, it's been repeating so fucking often. Like the guy upstairs is George R.
We're on like season 12 now,
It's all the fucking same.
He's using ChatGPT at this point to write the
But he invented it a while ago. Both of you are brilliant journalists. JT, also actually a journalist. Me, don't fucking ask me. Political science, fucking mythical fucking thing that isn't really a science. But imagine being a historian and I'm talking like university professor type of level or a historic researcher and so on. And everything you do, 24/7, is history. That's literally all that you do. How incredibly mind-numbing it might be to find all of these patterns that continuously repeat, and you're shouting at the top of your lungs at absolutely fucking everybody, and yet nobody kind of learns the lesson. Not to, toot our own horn as Marxists or whatever, but at the end of the day, it can very much
The Marxists didn't even learn the lesson because they went into fucking Afghanistan. And, what's funny is that, and I'll shut up and let Noah take the next one, but the Politburo, Kosygin, who was the prime minister at the time, or the premier at the time, Gromyko, the top diplomat, when they're turning down the Afghans, the Afghan communists, for the 8 months or so before the invasion, they're saying quite clearly and unambiguously, you don't want your people to turn against a foreign invader coming in and staying. We saw how that goes a couple years ago with the Americans. If the Vietnamese can sort out their country with support from outside, but not an invasion, so can you, and people don't forgive that kind of thing, is what Kosygin says, mm-hmm. An invading army. So they were very clear. And that's why they were so resigned by the end of it, going, I guess we're going to have to fucking try this. They were not excited about it, certainly not in the way that American policymakers had a grand chessboard in mind about Southeast Asian communism, one after another, being deprived of oxygen by a Vietnamese invasion. So, by the way, the American justification or the American explanation for all this was that the Soviets had a master plan, which we've just seen they didn't, to reach through a red Afghanistan into Iran, which they would then subvert or conquer, and take over the Persian Gulf, which was our territory, you know.
Yeah.
And that was what Carter said in an address to Congress. It was just a flat out declaration that this is what the Soviet motivations are. Other people say, oh, they wanted a warm water port. They always want a warm water port. Apparently, that was what people said they wanted in Korea. They never got that out of any of these conflicts. But it's this thing that sounds kind of smart, and then you know, the Soviet archives open up, and turns out they didn't fucking care about any of this shit.
The other, it like also hurt the Soviets a lot that Andropov, that his kidneys gave out because, you know, with like, it should not be understated. Like, ending a war is very tough. It's like, you know, like once you get things up and going and supply line, like, you know, especially it's hard enough when you do have a clear objective, and imagine when you don't. And so the one guy, it seems from the, you know, from the record, it now seems like the one guy who had the clout in the Soviet system at that level at that time to initiate that kind of policy shift was him. And he's gone in what, 83?
Yeah, he dies in the beginning of 84, and he was trying for the first 3 years of the war to end it. I mean, he wasn't premier until 82. Brezhnev died, and Brezhnev was the Soviet Joe Biden. He was basically just out to lunch, and he was 75. He was about 10 years younger than Joe is now. And even that was like, we got to get this guy, we got to shuffle him off. But But Andropov was a very interesting leader who was brutal as anyone would have to be as head of the KGB, and quite ruthless. But he was also very perceptive and, by all accounts, hyper intelligent and very interested, not in Gorbachev style surrender, but in a rational lessening of tensions internationally with the United States. And he wanted to get out of Afghanistan. You know, the sort of, I don't like throwing these terms around, but I think at the time there was kind of an unapologetic Western Marxist stance toward Afghanistan, like, no, they're defending the fucking international duty. And behind the scenes, Andropov, who these people tend to love, was like, let's get the fuck out. Fuck this. And he was doing all he could to get the United Nations to get talks going. And then he died. And Chernenko was another kind of just middling guy who didn't know what was going on, his successor. So it took Gorbachev, who was not so competent in most other ways, to at least revive Andropov's goal of extracting the Soviet Union from Afghanistan. But what happens then, of course, is the Americans make it as hard as possible for them to do that. And that's why the war drags on for another 7 years.
And they get their scalps. Yeah, I've talked
they
to
get
countless,
their scalps.
Yeah, I talked to not countless, to a few Afghan veterans, like these old fucking heads. And most of the rhetoric there is always like, you know, we were sent to do what we were sent to do. Everybody thought that they were going there for 3 to 6 months. The leadership was also always skeptical about for how long they're going to stay there. And, you know, you get your shit expanded 6 months plus, 6 months plus, 6 months plus, 6 months plus. And some of them ended up staying there for like at least half the period, because other than the higher echelons and so on, don't.
And that is like the American war, the recent one. I mean, it was not supposed to be 20 years. We know that.
Absolutely. And then also their kids, some very often like hardcore communists that they talk to, kids that had parents like Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians that had parents that were stationed there, you know, they will criticize the Soviet Union for the things that it absolutely deserves criticism, including this this particular war, even though, as we've discussed here, you know, it was kind of a lose-lose situation in general. But what makes me very sad is obviously talking to, you know, I'm not going to generalize and just say like Western comrades and so on, but, you know, it's mostly Western comrades who always think it needs to be this battle in which our guys always do good and their guys always do 100% bad. Well, your show makes a very good job, does a very good job at explaining just how much more fucking complicated than that it is. Which leads us to, I guess, the next conversation point. And now finally, JT, I'm handing it over to you. I'm sorry, my brother. to a part of, I would argue, Afghani history where it's a bit more cut and dry when it comes to good and bad.
Yeah, so let's move into the modern stuff a little bit, or the more modern stuff, I should say. This the whole Afghanistan debacle was inherited and dealt with and bungled by four consecutive American presidents. So let's start with good old W. Let's talk about the Bush years. As hard as it is for us geriatric millennials and boomers to accept, there are people listening to this right now who weren't even alive when 9/11 happened. So,
is there a boomer here? I'm not a boomer. I just want to make that clear.
It's you, Gopnik. It's he admitted it in the last episode.
He's honestly 67 years old.
Yeah, I might as well be a boomer. I don't know.
Genetically,
how
I probably am with this drinking and this lifestyle. Yeah, I'm probably.
Gopnik is always sending me TikToks. I'm like, just send me Twitter links of the TikToks.
Dude, they only send like homemade food or whatever, and I'm like shit faced in the fucking club, like fucking dying in a toilet.
Yeah,
and
now
I'm a fucking boomer. Yeah. Please.
Anyway, for the younger people in our audience. What is the connection between 9/11 and Afghanistan? Because I'm sure most young people listening associate W more with Iraq than Afghanistan.
Mm.
I would say that the way to sort of first think about it is that all of that violence that sort of comes from the Afghan war in the 1980s, people can listen to our podcast to get a more in-depth run of the 1990s. But even by the end of that period, there had been, you know, this kind of constant tumult. Eventually, the Afghan Communist Party government falls, and then there's this fighting among warlords for power, and then the Taliban arises, backed by the Pakistani secret services in the Afghan countryside, and they come into power and enforce this, you know, sort of like brutal. Islamist patriarchy that people have, you know, like there was never anything like it at that time. And the Taliban had, you know, they held a lot of esteem for the Mujahideen warriors and Islamist fighters from the 1980s period. And Osama bin Laden had been a, if people know anything about 9/11, they know that he's the guy who said to have done it. And bin Laden was a, you know, he's a playboy son, effectively, by this, you know, Islam, playboys, I'm being ironic, like he's the wayward son. Of,
the bad boy.
It's better. Yeah, he's the bad boy's son of a Saudi family that is, you know, they're one of the few Saudi families that's not part of the House of Saud, but that is that are billionaires. And they made that money through construction. And bin Laden, you know, he gets religion, he goes to Afghanistan, and by the 90s he's in Sudan, and then the Americans they kick him out of Sudan. Out of Khartoum, and he goes back to Afghanistan, where the Taliban host him. And so, as of 2001, the Taliban are not actually enemies of the Americans in this cut and dry way, as we may think today. Like basically the CIA and the American government and American oil companies, one in from California in particular, were negotiating with the Taliban for pipeline rights.
Mm.
And at the same time, the Taliban were hosting the Al-Qaeda network, which was this sort of loose network of Islamist fundamentalists, primarily based there, but also around the world, that included, you know, former veterans of the Mujahideen Wars. And these people are the ones who, you know, from Afghanistan, centrally organize, or at least are, you know, they're the people who, you know, our show goes into, like, I don't want to spoil too much. Like, we describe a little bit, you know, like with some more nuance, how this network carries out the 9/11 attacks. But, you know, I would say that because bin Laden is in Afghanistan and the Taliban is giving him sanctuary, and the Americans had done, you know, had in the process of negotiating well before 9/11 happened, for bin Laden's withdrawal, that they had, you know, committed a bunch of acts of pretty spectacular violence against Muslims around the world. The Taliban had felt that, we can't hand them over to these people. And so,
that's not true. I mean, the Taliban did at certain points feel
offers.
Okay with there were talks about handing bin Laden over. It was certainly considered. It was not, It was not.
Sorry.
Autonomy.
But I mean, it was. I'm saying that ultimately there was a reason that he was in Afghanistan and not in American custody,
right.
Back in Saudi Arabia, sure. As of September 2001. That's all I mean there. Not that they were resistant to negotiating.
Also, as far as a broader view, like Osama is, of course, his network, which was usually referred to as the Bin Laden Group, you know, before 2001. Then Al Qaeda became the more common term. That was in kind of certain interviews that this would come up as a phrase. Anyway, not to get semantic about it, that the Bin Laden Group or Al Qaeda have plenty of connections to Afghanistan themselves personally. Osama was recruiting with associates in New York, in Brooklyn, not far from where I'm recording this, to get guys to Afghanistan from around the world in the 1980s. And interestingly, the U.S. government was aware of that and was surveilling it and didn't mind it at all, of course, because these were our friends at the time. We spoke to a guy, he's a professor at the National Defense University, so he technically works for the DOD. And he was like, yeah, someone was just purposefully looking the other way. Huh. We're like, yeah, that scans. Wow. By the 90s, the Afghan jihad is over, but the jihad spreads around the world as a larger, you know, now confederation of groups and veterans of it. You have the Philippines, where the ISIS in the Philippines right now is founded back then, in a group called Abu Sayyaf. You have Bosnia, Jugopnik, in the Balkans. You had Al-Qaeda going to Bosnia to fight.
Yep.
And that was well known at the time. And the Saudis were building mosques and building schools and building all kinds of stuff in Bosnia. And
they still do to this day. They still do.
Still do. And Izetbegovic, you know, was viewed in the West as this kind of basically the good guy. In the Bosnian conflict, but he either became more influenced by the heavy hitter, you know, Islamic governments of the Middle East and South Asia that were supporting him, or the fighters that were traveling to Bosnia, or that was his sympathy the whole time. I don't know, but Bosnia, Algeria had a incredibly destructive, dirty war that was, you know, basically driven by a one party state starting to get challenged by Islamists, but then the Islamists losing. Completely losing the sympathy of the population because of their brutality. And this was all like a vortex had been opened coming out of the immense materiel and training and victory of the Afghan Mujahideen with the support of the United States, Pakistan, the Chinese communists, and Saudi Arabia and others. So, and Israel. So the connection to 9/11 is America finally gets a taste in 2001. Mm-hmm. But all these other places had initially as well. And there are more interesting and bizarre things that come up in the web of connections, you know, of guys inside of the U.S. taking the flight classes. And we get into all of that, too. There's a lot of spooky stuff that still goes on there because we never really let go of the idea that Islamic militants could often, if not all the time, serve our interests somewhere. And so a lot of these guys, the FBI knew and the CIA knew, the hijackers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's tons of connections.
Yeah. So thanks to all this stuff simmering in the background for so long and then sparked by the war on terror, the Americans finally they're acquainted with it properly. You know, most people were tangentially aware of this stuff going on, but it really became the American thing when the war on terror kicked off.
Mm-hmm.
That's when most people became aware of the scope of what was going on. Could you give us just a quick rundown of the main players in the war on terror, how the war was sold to the public, and what was going on behind the scenes? Because I'm sure there was more off-the-record targets or goals, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't just what was told to the American people.
Yeah, I think the way to, like, you know, to define, like, what is the war on terror, I would define it, Brendan, feel free to disagree, is that it was a policy paradigm.
I disagree. Just kidding. Sorry. I'm just kidding.
Damn it. In a policy program that was international in its scope and was organized around the idea that there were non-state combatants, all over the world that needed to be targeted in a, you know, new kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And this included international security cooperation agreements that exist to this day. It included, and that includes obviously personnel and monetary resources, the setting up new military bases. It also meant the loosening of surveillance standards as Americans quickly, in a few years would find out whether it was the phone companies wiretapping illegally or the Snowden revelations of stuff like PRISM. And there was also, I think, with the war on terror, you know, it's a in recent American history, there are successive national security and foreign policy frameworks that help to explain a lot of, you know, how decisions get made and how the people making them conceive of them within the grand scheme of things. And so in 1986, for example, Ronald Reagan, you know, makes, you know, like he announces that like America is declaring war on international drug traffickers and so on. Mm-hmm. And you have this, you know, a national security decision directive that formalizes that. And the war on terror is kind of like that in the sense that you have this, you know, now a formal in a whole bunch of different fashions. New courts, new surveillance systems and new courts to check the surveillance powers that are on terms favorable to the people conducting the surveillance and so on. So there's a way in which I think that like the war on terror, it was targeting everybody and everything, all in the name of fighting this like, you know, fairly ambiguous threat. And it was sold to the public in, you know, fairly explicit terms, just about like we need to be secure. And, you know, and that's why the Patriot Act, you know, which includes things that had been, you know, and ideas that had been in the water since the 1980s, you know, being and passed or thought up by people who had been in government in the 1980s, like Rumsfeld.
And who were in government then. Yeah Rumsfeld and Cheney.
Exactly.
They worked on continuity of government. I'm sure you guys have run into this. And these were longstanding sort of Strangelovian plans about what if we got decapitated in New York, or rather in Washington. And wouldn't you know it, as soon as 9/11 happens, there's a lot of that stuff gets dug up again. About just warrantless surveillance, disappearing people, habeas corpus goes bye-bye. You know, these were things that rendition and ways to skirt around the existing constitutional expectations of both Congress and the American public. This was being discussed way back in the day by two of the guys who are now respectively vice
president.
Oh, more
than two. I mean, Richard Perle's
but on the very top of the top, the Secretary of Defense and the vice president, these were not like, as you say, Noah, like Richard Perle's, Paul Wolfowitz style underlings. These were like guys, in the Cheney's case, maybe literally the guy in charge.
You're always discounting Jewish achievement, and it really disturbs me.
I know. Yeah, it's funny. I'm trying to be like less tropey about it, and you're pulling me into it. But I just wanted to add that about the war on terror stuff. Like, as far as Afghanistan goes, and we have an interesting challenge in this season because it's very vast. The running time on this episode of your guys' show will clearly attest to. So we have an interesting challenge this season because, you know, we're very openly admitting in the first episode, it's our most ambitious season. We're trying to cover decades, you know. I mean, Iraq War, we always do a bit of background, but Iraq War was almost a decade. Korean War was 3 years. You know, Cuban revolution to missile crisis is a span of 3 or 4 years, you know. So this is decades. And that's a different level of storytelling that we're trying. And I think it's been very exciting, and I hope people find it exciting. But you have to be very, you know, you have to kill your darlings. You have to pick the stories that keep you on topic. So there's a lot of stuff you go into. But as far as Afghanistan goes, who are the main players? How does it basically factor into the war on terror? I think that one of the most popular conceptions, I won't say whether it's a misconception or not, about Afghanistan is that it was the good war compared to the bad war of Iraq. And I understand why people would think that, particularly liberal-minded people who think, well, we had to do something about 9/11, but then Bush got imperial and hubristic. And then there's just, on those terms, there's, of course, an excess in Iraq that, you know, doesn't exist in Afghanistan. There's absolutely no connection between the supposed defensive posture of America after 9/11 and Iraq. But Afghanistan, in its own way, is a more insidious war because it is the foundation of the war on terror. It is the foundation of torture regimes that we had always outsourced before, but began to enhance, no pun intended, you know, on a level that really we started to take a much more proactive approach toward renditioning people, torturing them, allowing us to just kind of do whatever we wanted or give people to others who could do whatever they wanted. Bagram Air Base had a detention center at the very beginning of the war that was the Abu Ghraib of Afghanistan, and we talk about that. And it was before Abu Ghraib was even converted. And so a lot of ugly stuff begins there. A lot of the most bizarre, and if you want to, you know, kind of disregard the assurances of our kind of official history and our, you know, what our leaders tell us, a lot of the confusing stuff about why, what's going on with Pakistan? why are all these Taliban guys escaping and Al-Qaeda guys escaping into Pakistan? Why is Pakistan our ally when they seem to be giving, you know, succor and protection to these guys? Why are they notoriously giving safe houses around to everybody?
Why is Pakistan not India? Wait, that's for my other podcast. I'm sorry.
Well, then, and then, of course, you know, India is something we have to try to make reference to a lot as well when we can, because Pakistan's actions make no sense. If you just think of like, yeah, why are they doing all this? It seems insane because they themselves get Islamic militants turning on them. But of course, for them, it's a problem to be managed and used against India rather than a problem in and of itself. What I guess I'm saying is that it's the ground zero, if you will, for all the excesses that lead to things like the war in Iraq and things we associate with the war in Iraq. They're all happening in Afghanistan, and they begin to happen everywhere else. The shady kleptocratic governments in Central Asia, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, the guys that, you know, dip their political opponents in oil, you know, where we're making deals with them for military bases. And of course, China is starting to get very nervous and probably regretting its cooperation on the Mujahideen, because that's where we start to get closer to China's borders and the extremist separatists and Muslim separatists that China's been worried about for years and years in the Uyghur provinces. You know, that's that they were in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and they were there in the 1990s. And now we were using the war on terror to set up shop very close to China. So the players are, again, the Saudis, who went back to the agreements between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. And we see the Bin Laden family spirited out of harm's way when the 9/11 attacks happen. The Pakistani ISI, who worked with us for many, many years. We have our problems with them, but they are once again an ally. And so, yeah, all of this stuff is a kind of mirror universe to what was happening in the 1980s. And it's a very fascinating thing to try to put them both in the same season.
Yeah, I mean, you guys had a huge undertaking doing this. So it sounds like the war on terror kind of served the same purpose as the war on drugs or the war on crime, where, you know, it's very vague and it allows for a sweeping overhaul of certain powers to the benefit of those at the levers.
Mm-hmm.
So let's fast forward just a little bit. Bush goes away. Obama takes office in 2009, and he decides to commit to what's referred to as the surge, which is a major commitment of troops to Afghanistan. What was the reasoning behind that? Did it improve the situation, or, as usually happens with U.S. military meddling, did it make it worse?
The surge is Afghan policy, even, you know, as 2009, right? Like, Obama has come into office arguing, this is the good war. You know, this is where we're this is where we're supposed to be. And that, it turns out, is of course easier said than done. After seeing the temporary success of the surge in Iraq, there is the thought, like, well, we need to have we just need to put a new face, have a new idea for how we're going to approach the situation in Afghanistan. And so they immediately, you know, they have a guy, they have a star general, Stanley McChrystal. And as Richard Holbrooke, for example, whose perspective, we discuss in the show, who is a sort of floating envoy on this issue in the Obama years, but who is actually like a Hillary Clinton confidant, you know, they're trying to figure out, like, well, what would a political settlement look like? You actually have just instead this, you know, sort of surge meant to consolidate the unpopular and shitty Hamid Karzai government. And so the surge, in effect, ultimately just like consolidates like the state authority and binds America to the hip of this Karzai guy, whom we have to, unfortunately, continue like rigging the political arena for. All the while, like the contractor gravy train continues apace and in fact like expands as like, you know, conditions for Afghans in the countryside are, you know, like remain terrible, and Kabul just becomes this kind of, you know, like contractor ISAF, that's the international like Afghan force designation, an NGO sort of like playpen is a little bit too glib of a term, but I think you get the idea.
Yeah.
I would say also this is a something that does not get better during the Obama run either, is we should mention a big angle of this season that I think is underplayed in a lot of cases is the heroin factor.
Yeah.
The opium wars, of course, the British, you know, they like music, pop music, Beatles, and you know, The Office, you know, they came up with it first, but the heroin production in Afghanistan by the time the Americans took over was 90% market share of the world's heroin market.
Wow.
It was the absolute, far and away, the largest heroin producer in the world. And after withdrawal, the Taliban have cut back on production, maybe because they don't believe in it, but maybe because they want to keep prices high. I don't give the Taliban as much credit as they
no
may want.
No H in the Balkans. Like, there's absolutely no fucking H in the Balkans.
Oh, we'll fix that. Don't worry. We're getting there. We're getting there. But the market share is still somewhere around 90% upon withdrawal. And you could look back in history. We did that in Southeast Asia, of course, the Golden Triangle. Afghanistan was the new place to do that. And our Mujahideen friends and the ISI of Pakistan, they essentially started the trade with the CIA in Afghanistan. And it was a big part of fundraising off the books. You know, we did give real congressional approved money eventually, but we also gave, through banks like BCCI and others, a lot of off the books money. We may never know how much money we really gave because so much of it was illicit. Mm. And then you have the Americans invade after the Taliban have, the first time in the 1990s, banned heroin cultivation or poppy cultivation for heroin. And all of a sudden, wouldn't you know it, the heroin numbers start going up. Huh. And I would say, as you, to link it to the war on terror, as you compared the two, JT, like the war on drugs, the war on terror was never so much about stamping out terror per se, nor was the war on drugs about stamping out drugs per se, but sorting out the market share. In other words, as we see in the case of heroin production in Afghanistan, America and its allies bickering all the time, some well-meaning people here or there, but they're allied. They weren't jailing or prosecuting anyone running heroin. We were jailing the insurgents who were running heroin, hunting down the kind of enemies who were running heroin. Not Hamid Karzai's brother, for example. Mm-hmm. And with terror, whether it's the 1980s or the 2000s or now, say, in Syria, we don't stamp out anyone doing terror or terror groups, you know, that exist per se, but the ones that are not advancing our interests.
Yeah.
Anyone who wants to do a solid, even for a limited run of time, who are doing terrorism, you're not really pursued in the war on terror. As you know, we talked about in Bosnia. I mean, it was pre-war on terror, but we didn't like terrorism before we called it this phrase. It was in Bosnia or in parts of Central Asia. We knew these guys from the Afghan War, and they were doing this. They were on the same team, and so they were not included in the hunts and the manhunts and the all that
same
stuff.
Like the Contras in South America blowing up hospitals and government buildings.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
not
of course.
Terrorism, because our guys.
It's only terrorism when the bad guys do it. Yeah.
But even more than that,
it needs to be said.
That's true. But I mean, even guys we call terrorists, like we call Nusra a terrorist organization technically. Yeah. Like the Contras were freedom fighters, right? But even when we call them terrorists, I'm saying, you know, in America. Even when we call them that, we have to admit, like, yeah, that's Al Qaeda. We're still behind the scenes. We're still funding them because they're against whatever branch of ISIS is currently anti-American, you know. Mm. And anyway, the Obama years, the corruption got even worse. The violence continued, and the lying got way worse, or at least got significantly worse. The Afghanistan Papers is a collection of internal government interviews we drew from a lot by this great journalist called Craig Whitlock. And his contention is that even more than Bush, who was busy lying about Iraq, maybe more than Afghanistan, the Obama people just, they were pretty shameless in how often and frequently they said, the war is picking up, don't worry. That was Vietnam-like. And the and then they said they were going to withdraw in 2014, and it never happened.
And they also had a like the policy of, you know, like Vietnamization was the buzzword in the Johnson administration at one point. And if there's like an Afghan analog there, it's the night raids and the fact that, as you can read in ProPublica, that like we just basically we created Afghan death squads and like by the government, by the state. And, you know, these were not like so, which is just to say that like our state development projects there were totally focused on all the wrong things. And, you know, it sort of that was the platter that was handed to Trump.
I think we talk a lot more about corruption and the ins and outs and the structure of it this season with the Karzai government and the Ghani government that followed it than we have with governments in the past. So that was a fun thing. It was kind of doing the kind of mafia charts of the capos and the bosses, you know, in charge.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear about that. I love that stuff. Okay, so Bush made the problem worse. Obama made the problem worse. Now we get to our big wet boy, Donald Trump.
Mm.
When Obama left office, the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan had dwindled from something like 100,000 to just around 10,000, right?
So POC respecting POC. It's very nice to see.
Exactly. Obama's goal had been to get out of the country entirely, but his admin determined that it just wasn't feasible at the time. So they kicked the can down the road to the next guy. Yeah. And by this point, I think most Americans were kind of burned out on the whole ordeal. So give us a quick recap. What did Trump actually do in Afghanistan? Because he talked a big game about bringing the troops home. So mm-hmm. to what extent did that happen, or did anything happen?
Oh, a lot happened. And it's actually somewhat reminiscent of the Korean charm offensive that we talked mm-hmm. about last season, except he actually succeeded in what he was setting out to do this time. And what happened was he didn't pull the troops out. There wasn't time enough. He wanted to pull the troops out in time for the election.
Yeah.
It's probably good for him. I know he lost anyway, but, well, of course, I don't believe he lost. But,
I know he lost. Vaxxed?
Afghanistan vaxxed? I know that he lost anyway, but it's probably good for him. We saw how everyone hated how it went down with Biden. Yeah. We'll get to that. But, what he did do was very important for what came next, which is he made the deal. I got to give him it. He made the deal. He was actually almost a parody of himself behind the scenes going, get me my deal with the Taliban, okay? And he would go, he gave them like a really, really short deadline, like 9 months. And Zalmay Khalilzad, who was an Afghan-American who had been basically viceroy in Afghanistan during the Bush administration until he had to go over and do Iraq. He was like a kind of a, hey, it's talking crusty. I'm viceroy of Afghanistan. but he was put in charge of the negotiations. He's a stalwart Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to put any kind of moral gloss on it. It's a bunch of scumbags, whichever way you slice it. It's the Taliban and the Trump administration. But what's interesting is that the Afghan government, more scumbags, were kept out of the talks. It was not a peace deal between the U.S., the Afghan government and the Taliban. It was just between the Taliban and the U.S. Because the thinking on both sides was, well, we're the ones really fighting.
Yeah.
You know, the Afghanistan government, much as in the Soviet era, they're kind of a junior partner in the coalition, if you will. I know Noah loves that phrase. So that negotiation took place and was signed. And that meant that Trump couldn't tout it, the actual troop withdrawal.
Yeah.
But that Biden, if he wanted to, I guess he could have shrunk from it and somehow found a way not to make it happen. But turns out Biden, who had hated the Afghan commitment for years since he was VP, he, of course, enthusiastically voted for the authorization of military force, but he was quite soured on it by the time he was VP. He wanted out. And so to what degree Joe really runs the show, I don't know, but he did. And I think the Pentagon was burned out. I mean, 20 years is pretty bad.
It was, and this was like, there was no longer, I think that the, you know, once upon a time, like they wanted to bottle this up, but now, you know, I mean, like we haven't really talked about Xinjiang, but once upon a time, that was a lot of the reason why China, I mean, at least like that was, you know, that has been a lot of their rationale for participating in this, is that they care about like having influence over what goes on in Xinjiang, you know, in their own territory. Mm-hmm. And now that, you know, I mean, just to bring it up, I mean, same with Iran, you know, just to say that like there are new frontiers emerging you know, new potential fissures for America to exploit, and like to what extent maintaining a continued American troop presence was strategically useful, you know, remains in question. We'll see as time goes on. But I think it sort of is becoming clear, I think, that it was actually like, no, it wasn't useful at all.
So, all right, we only get one term of the dang Cheeto in the White House.
Don't speak too soon.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Oh my God,
all
the 30 indictments and stuff. It's just galvanizing the base.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. Anyway, so we get to good old Joe Biden's presidency, Jim Crow Joe. There were something like 2,500 U.S. troops remaining in Afghanistan when he took office, I think. And
but by the way, a lot of military contractors, tens of thousands of more contractors who effectively look, if you're in a country, they look exactly like troops to you, and sometimes behave even worse. But yes.
Oh, yeah. It's nicer that way. I mean, the U.S. can wash its hands of it and say, hey, we're officially out of this country. But if it's, you know, PMCs,
yep.
Who knows? But anyway, Biden
Big
announced
boss.
That all of the all of the official U.S. troops would be coming home by September 11th, 2021, which is a full two decades after 9/11. And then everything kind of went to shit. So tell us a little bit about the, you know, the more or less final withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I just realized the reason I'm always guilty when I see the time, the running time of an episode, but you're getting two guests for the price of one episode, you know. So
exactly.
I guess we're double.
This is a tremendous
we're double
value.
The length. Double the length. Yeah. Double the guests.
Yes, and we're not parasites like some fucking podcast that like will cut this episode into three different episodes so they can milk it.
This is
piece. This is one fucking chunky piece. You gotta give the people their content. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. What was the question? Biden and the withdrawal, right?
Yeah.
Biden bad, withdrawal good or bad question.
Yeah. Yes. So this is interesting. I mean, I will leave it to people to get to the end of our show, which is the most important thing, guys, is that they sign up at blowback.show immediately. And
link
go
below.
Listen. Link below. But
look at how they're torturing themselves only to introduce you to Blowback. Fucking 2 hours, 2 hours with me and JT. That is fucking nightmare fuel, even for me. And I do this for a living.
You guys were flown in to Guantanamo quite often to just talk to people and torture them in your conversation. Yeah. I know that. I think that there was an interesting point at which we started, you know, we were interviewing people. No one's happy with the withdrawal. I mean, let's put it that way. I mean, for different reasons.
I mean, the Taliban looks pretty fucking happy.
The Taliban looks happy. Okay. Let me rephrase. Everyone except the Taliban was pretty bummed out. And that's understandable. I mean, you know, you see the footage, you read the articles about people just like just trying to grab on to, you know, U.S. copters for dear life. Yeah. It's bad. There's no doubt about that. And the resumption of Taliban rule is not a win for civilization, let's say. Mm. However, and I think various people have made this point, we talk a bit about the execution. I think the Biden administration was trying to not even do it on the cheap, but not present the idea that the Kabul government would need so much backup months and months ahead of time, because that would start to almost fulfill the prophecy that they're weak enough that the Taliban would think like, oh, maybe we should just move in. Either way, the Taliban moved in, and to really pull the view screen back, it's almost inevitable that this was going to happen. I mean, I won't put that as my own opinion, but the people we interviewed, several we interviewed said, I mean, what's interesting about the U.S. media's outrage over it, some of which is coming from an understandable place, but a lot of it is also browbeating a president for not occupying a country even longer.
True.
The thing is that the outrage and the highlighting of suffering, which is all true, happened in that week after he withdrew. Biden withdrew the troops. It's been 20 years of war under U.S. occupation, and it got, you know, the equivalent of, you know, 5 minutes attention in that time span. Whether Iraq was overshadowing it, whether it was move on to, Obama's taking care of it now, so it's good. Or Libya's the new hotness. Or, there's no war on terror anymore. Are we even still there? It was this admittedly dramatic and outrageous exit that got people's attention, but all the violence and all the chaos and all of the grim realities in the 19 years before that are just not a factor Mm-hmm. And also not used as any part of the explanation as to why this might be happening. It's only because of something that the Biden administration could have or could not have done before they did this. And I think that's just a unfortunately predictably narrow way of looking at the entire event. And so you have this war that's 20 years bookended by very dramatic things, 9/11 and the withdrawal, and really no account or reckoning about anything that happened in between. That's how I would parse how Americans have processed the withdrawal. Of course, yeah. Afghans, we spoke to one of our main guests is a woman named Malalai Joya, who was a particularly brave woman in Afghanistan. She was the youngest MP and the only woman MP for many years, or the first woman MP in the new government, rather. And she got driven out of the country because of her stance against the warlords that we worked with, who were all just as bad as the Taliban, some even more brutal, who were our friends from the Mujahideen days. And she went into exile, and she's in exile because the Taliban are back. And as she put it, she hates how the withdrawal went down. She thinks that the Biden government stitched everybody up. But the way she put it before this even happened was, we have three enemies in Afghanistan. One is the Taliban insurgency, or the Taliban coming back. One is the warlords, aka the government, and one is the U.S. occupation. Take away one of those for us, please. And the one we took away was the occupation. And the war, and I guess you could argue the warlords as well, because most of them fled. You're still left with a horrible status quo. There's no way to spin it.
Yeah.
There.
No. I mean, that's like 20 years. You're so ingrained in the society, you know, for better or for worse. I mean, obviously for worse. But at that point, even with the best intentions, what could you do? I mean, you've been a destabilizing force in a destabilized place already. And then removing yourself from the situation, also going to destabilize. It was just a bad situation.
And there were, and the best, and the intentions were not of the best.
No,
so that definitely
no,
wasn't going to happen. But the thing I'm interested in, in looking at now, we've done this season, we've learned a lot, and we're, you know, of course, slightly more literate than we were to begin with. The thing I'm curious about is what happens with the U.S. and the Taliban, because there were some U.S. officials just this month that went over to visit. And it was the first time any U.S. officials had visited since the withdrawal. And we still have frozen their assets in banks, which people rightly, you know, point to the suffering of the Afghan people, much like Iraq in the 90s. However, there is also some evidence from whistleblowers within the government who are either resigned or on their way out, who are not so sure that money isn't getting to the Taliban from these smaller disbursements that are supposed to go still to the. They're not the giant frozen funds, but they're these other funds that are supposed to go to the people of Afghanistan. And we know that they're going to the Taliban, and we're not moving on it. And we all know we started our relationship with the Taliban as potential partners, not identical in our exact goals or in our stated values or whatever you want to say it, our suits and ties and all that, but that we could work with them and live with them, as one State Department official put it back in the 90s. So I'm curious to see. The Taliban do not like Iran very much. There have been clashes with Iran. They don't like certain other terror groups that we are currently beefing with. I don't think it'll happen overnight, but I'm interested to see if we'll come full circle back to where we were before Bin Laden screwed it all up for them, you know?
Jeez, what a saga. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows what the future holds? Weeks, decades, etc. Well, there you go, folks. Now you know everything that has ever happened in Afghanistan.
No, you don't. You have to listen to the season and sign up.
My mistake. You have to click the link below in order to listen to Blowback Season 4, available August 24th, which I think is the day this episode comes out.
So, 25th.
August 25th, which I think is the day this episode comes out.
And also, if you want to just, you know, skip right on ahead to go and subscribe for the show, go to www.blowback.show and you can just get it from right there. Well, click it and you'll get it right, you know, all private feed, all 10 episodes of the main narrative, and then 10 bonus episodes. We have some really sick interviews lined up.
Ad-free back catalog, extra goodies, you know, music, soundtrack stuff. This season we are putting out merch.
Yo.
We have long been dragging our feet on merch, but we have some, I think, pretty great t-shirts that we're still working on the designs for. But I think people are going to be pretty jazzed about them. So
little
that's
teaser?
A new thing.
Can you give our boys a little teaser?
let's just say, as a part of subscription, you'll get a code for a discount.
And as a part of promoting the merch, they will send at least one size of each shirt that they made to their ally podcast hosts, who can also co-promo it, right?
Yes, absolutely. You've earned it. If you've been quote unquote holding us hostage, we've been holding you hostage. It's a symbiotic relationship. One of us is the Venom symbiote.
Yeah.
But as far as a teaser of what it is, I'll just I think heads will know. I'll just say Afghanistan is a big place. That's what I would say about the designs that may or may not be coming down the pipe with the t-shirts. So stay tuned.
Hell yeah, that's what I like.
Okay, I'll send you my address later.
Please do. I actually already have it.
They're recording this from Langley, Virginia.
I told you their production quality is too fucking good.
It's
fucking fed fucks.
You know what's funny is if the CIA does have a podcast, which they almost probably do because like Walmart has podcasts for its employees.
Oh, they do.
Now.
It's garbage. We've listened to it. It's
oh, that's
ass.
Funny. Oh, I'd love to hear that. that I'm sure the CIA does podcasts either for the public or for themselves, and it actually probably sounds like shit. I've heard some of these official they don't shell out for the real mics.
Do they have small ads from like MailChimp?
Do you hate going to the post office when you're trying to form a death squad?
None of our agents engage in wet work without first manscaping. Yeah.
when you're mailing that heroin in the Golden Triangle, man, you don't want to have to go to the post office and send that heroin from stamps.com.
The reason they never find us is because we use NordVPN. There you go. We're going to cut these guys loose. Patrons, thank you all for listening. We appreciate you very much. Mwah, big kisses all around. Be sure to click the link in the description. Check out Blowback. Fantastic series. I can vouch for it personally. I've listened to every single episode. It is well worth your time. So, Brendan, Noah, thank you guys for coming on. And with all that being said, this has been the Deprogram. I'm JT.
I'm Ugopnik.
Are you saying it?
I thought Noah was going to say it.
I thought you were going to say it.